This episode is sponsored by a company who has truly found a solution to an age-old problem, and that is Carna Bunker Gear. One of the most prevalent conversations in the fire service is, should we or should we not train in our bunker gear? Now, the answer to both is yes. As most of us are aware, the carcinogens from structure fires, of which there are over 260 that are dangerous to human health, not to mention the PFAS and other chemicals that are within our gear from the manufacturing process, are factors that we obviously want to minimize. Now, the other side of the coin is that we do need to train in our gear. There is no way to acclimatize the heat retention and lack of mobility than to actually wear the gear. So seeing this problem himself, firefighter and exercise physiologist Ryan Conley developed a carcinogen-free gear at a much lower cost that can be used in non-IDLH atmosphere and training that does not require puncture or tear resistance. Now, as someone who always trained in gear myself throughout my career, I wish this technology was around then. And I got to test it personally while coaching my tactical athlete class a few weeks ago and can testify that it not only simulates the heat retention of frontline gear, but also the lack of mobility, which is imperative at operating at a high level on the fire ground. Now, some additional benefits include being able to doff the gear when you do get banged out for a call, increasing the lifespan of your frontline bunker gear, and then also public education. Think of the number of times that we allow, for example, school children to wear our gear when it's infused with all these carcinogens. So there are so many real-world applications for a fraction of the cost of IDLH-rated bunker gear. So if you want to hear the whole story behind this, listen to my conversation with Ryan Conley on episode 1175 of the Behind the Shield podcast, or go to carnabunkergear.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome back onto the show veteran wildland firefighter and the co-founder of Wild Fit Life 805, Justin Mahaffey. Now, if you didn't hear my first conversation with Justin, you truly must. And that was episode 876, as he has a very powerful story. In the second conversation, we jump right into the current state of the Wildland Fire Service, the challenges they're facing from residents of their communities, navigating their grief after losing a son to a drunk driver, the strength and conditioning coaching they offer online, their supplements, and so much more. Now, before I get to this incredibly powerful conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of almost 1,200 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So that being said, I welcome back onto the show Justin Mahaffey. Enjoy. Well, Justin, I want to start by saying thank you so much for coming back onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
It's an honor to be back, man. I was looking forward to talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. So we spoke 2 years ago now, episode 876 for people that are listening. I guess the first icebreaker would be from the fireside. Talk to me about either the evolution or even devolution of the wildland side that you've observed the last couple of years.
Well, it's continued to decline. You know, it's harder to get people to stay with us. They did a little raise, which is better, but it still won't keep people around. It's still not enough. So same problems, not able to staff, not able to fight fire aggressively in some situations like we normally would. So just continuing to decline. The leaders won't make the powerful right decisions that are necessary. And I don't think they, you know, at a local level, they don't have the power to do so. It comes from higher and higher and higher. So it's just a continuous problem.
I know we're right, you know, jumping into this topic straight away, but if you were king for a day and you could literally, you know, fund what needs to be funded and put programs in place to attract young people back into the Wildland Fire Service, what would be the changes that you'd make to turn this around?
Well, it wouldn't be immediate. The pay is the ultimate thing. If you can pay these kids enough to stick around, then you can have people stick around, which will create the leadership in years down the road that would make the newer generation also want to stay because of the powerful leadership in place. So it's money. It's pay, changing that right away, because the job's not going to change. It is what it is. We could have better tools. We could have, you know, better resources, but the job in itself, fighting wildland fire, is the same. It's just about the pay and keeping people around so you, in the future, you have better leadership, because that's the problem. We're losing our high quality leaders are going to other agencies that are all risk, and then they're getting out of the wildland for the most part and doing all the other stuff. So I think the answer would be money. You know, I would pay an appropriate wage to keep people invested in it as a career. You know, we got people leaving to Costco that have been doing this for 20 years.
See, this is what's so crazy. If you look at most of the issues that we have, not just in our profession, but in other areas too, it's always the false economy. This term comes up over and over and over again. You make cuts, you take shortcuts, and it ends up costing, you know, far much more down the road, whether it's losing firefighters themselves, whether it's communities that lost homes because they weren't able to defend that particular area. And so proactively investing in, for example, the Wildland Fire Service, so you have enough people, you have enough resources, they're working, you know, in an environment that doesn't kill them, you know, that would save money hand over fist. And it drives me crazy that that is such a foreign concept to people that are supposed to be the gurus in the financial world.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing annually. It just gets worse and worse. And then they'll spend millions on drops from aircraft that they could have placed paying people to, you know, there's just so many different things that, you know, it's ridiculous.
When you talk to some of the old heads in the profession, what were the differences back then? Is it just that the acuity and the frequency of the fires are getting worse, or was there a different kind of leadership 20, 30 years ago?
Well, the fires were definitely not as bad, not as many and not as big, but also life was different. You know, more people were willing to live in the rural areas and have less, make a life of it. Life was smaller, I think. Life is bigger now. Life is more expensive. So all those things play a factor. You know, you're not going to bring these kids now out to our stations with no cell service, with rat infested bunk areas. And when they live here in this life, it's just, everything has changed. So the dynamics back then were different. The pay was somewhat reasonable then, I think, comparatively, because shit, we barely got any sort of raise since then. They haven't even changed it much, you know? So it's all those factors, you know, people, you have your type of person who likes living out in that way, and you have less people that like that, I think, nowadays, especially with all the technology.
I saw something on social media, and again, did not research it, so it might not be accurate, but what it was saying was, I think it was in the 60s or 70s, I think it was around that era, that someone in college could basically earn their annual college fees over the summer. So you'd have a summer job, you'd work full time then, and then that would pretty much cover your university for the next two semesters. And you compare and contrast. Now, my wife just came out of med school with basically $500,000 worth of debt, is what it, you know, that's what it costs anyone to go into medicine these days. So, you know, it's this kind of inequity that's got worse and worse and worse. It's not that people are wanting, you know, to live in mansions and have all these luxuries now, just the cost of doing the same exact thing that our parents or even grandparents did that was affordable today is completely unaffordable. And living in the 100%. Area where you're a firefighter is a perfect example of that.
Yeah, this is especially here in California and Southern California, right? This is the hotspot for wildfires, and you cannot afford to live here and just fight fire. If my wife didn't have a job, we couldn't have the house that we do. You know, I see it with my kids, with the economy, like they can't go out and get an apartment by themselves. They need six roommates. You know, it's crazy times. It really is. You know, the rent here? If you can find a good two bedroom apartment, you're probably paying $2,800, $3,000 a month. And that's if you're lucky.
Yeah.
It's impossible. Yeah. At first, when my kids were becoming adults, it's like, go get out on your own, you know? But the reality is, I'd rather them pay rent here and then be able to buy a house, you know, because it's impossible. And it's fun to go get six roommates and live that life a little bit, but that you have to do that is very sad.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. What about technology? I've had some people on the show recently talking about drones. There's another one. I forget the product's name, but it's literally a robotic dozer that goes out and cuts lion on its own. You see these drones responding to a fire when it's first started, so they're able to tell exactly where it is and direct airdrops or crews specifically to that area. What are some of the exciting innovations that you're seeing from the ground?
So the drones show up pretty good. We only have so many people that are qualified to go do that, so you don't get them on every fire. You know, but they do try to get, it's normally a patrol will get those qualifications to be able to run the drone, and they'll show up, and it is very useful. It is. We can even use it to find heat and all, even in the mop up stage, or, you know, when you got a cold piece of, I mean, it's very useful. I love it. And it's nice to see when they show up. The dozer, haven't seen so much. I've seen them use those robotic ones to cut grass in, you know, along the highway, but not on the fire line. I haven't seen that.
Okay. I think Steve Wolf was the name. He was actually a movie pyro guy too, but he's also behind that, one of the technologies that does that.
Yeah. That'd be interesting to see. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, that'd be great. yeah, I haven't ran across that, but the drones are amazing, you know, and then it takes anytime you put a helicopter up in the air, man, it's risk. So it's nice to be able to have that kind of tool without risking someone's life every single time, you know?
I had a guy on the show, Richard Browning, who was behind, if you've ever seen it on Instagram, it's like the kind of Iron Man suit. They've got the jet packs that are on their arms. He's holding it on their arms. And he was talking about the application of mountain rescue, and they did it in the UK. They use paramedics, and you basically can take that pack, respond to, let's say in your environment, a firefighter who's down, immediately, you know, treat that firefighter, and then use a drone to take the stretcher down to the ambulance, and then off they go. So even from the EMS side on wildland fires, this application of technology is pretty exciting.
Yeah, that's huge, because it definitely out in the field, that's our biggest hurdle is the time crunch on trying to get to someone or get them the care that they need. If we're out in the middle of nowhere, even with my, you know, broken leg or something like that, that's huge.
Absolutely. What about the conversation when it comes to prescribed burns, to where people are allowed to build? I know a lot of the wildland firefighters, I'm sure we had this conversation the first time. You know, you're trying to do these preventative burns and local communities are fighting against it because they don't want smoke in their neighborhood, or they're allowed to build in an area that ultimately is going to put a lot of crews in danger if they have to respond during a fire. So what about that whole conversation?
Nothing has changed. It's continued to get worse. There is no fix. You know, it's like we talked about last time was the, I used seagulls, I believe, last time as a funny example, but it's the frogs. It's all the different stuff like that, that you can't do burns. And then people building houses, like you say, where they shouldn't, is a huge problem, especially here in Southern California, because they want the views or they want their privacy, or you got the people who want the land where they can grow weed. It's all those things. And it's a problem that's not going away.
See, what's crazy is, you know, I am not embedded in the wildland world. I mean, we did it in Anaheim, but there were the Green Gene guys that usually went and deployed, and I stayed with the municipal guys in the city. But we have these conversations with people like you and Ben Strawn and all these other, you know, Steve Wolf, and there are answers to these problems. And it blows me away that, again, the people that make the decisions that have these immense budgets don't listen to people who are on the ground and understand, hey, that the solutions are already there. We just have to, again, proactively invest and you know, tell the people, for example, that are using conservation as a way to combat prescribed burns. It's like, no, but this is going to conserve so much more when it comes to the proactive element of it. So I don't understand whether it's the Municipal Firefighters Work Week, whether it's what we're talking about with wildland, why people just don't have the humility to go to the people that have the answers and listen to them.
Yeah. I agree with you 100%. It's mind blowing. The answers are there. They always have been there. You know, with the, what did Trump say? Rake the forest, you know, we could do burns that would accomplish that view. But like you say, it's those things in the way that we can't. And then it also falls back to when we do have permission to do those burns in the right areas. Now we don't have the personnel to put it in place. The people with their burn boss qualifications are minimal because why? They're leaving to somewhere else with more money. So all those things continue to play a factor. You know, it's like you say, the answer's there. And I don't understand either why the people just won't make the right decisions. For example, look at, here's the local level one. I got offered a captain spot on an engine that would have staffed a whole nother module. And they didn't want to move this engine to a better location where I said I would take it. And we had other people that applied that would have, we could have filled this module. They would rather have it unstaffed at this other station because they don't want to say that they don't have an engine there. And it's been unstaffed for 5 years. And they could have made a small decision and we would have had a whole nother module filled. It's just, I don't understand the decision-making process at all. And I do say stuff. I even wrote a letter about it.
What about operational examples? The last couple of years, all the fires that either you personally have had or you've heard of nationally, what is the other side? What are some of the tragedies that are happening because of this understaffing, because of this lack of recruitment and retention that we're seeing both in your world and in mine?
You know, that's kind of a hard one. I wouldn't really want to place specific blame on someone's loss of life or something on that, but I do think it does equate to that in a lot of ways. But, you know, we get put in different kind of situations where the fire gets bigger because, like I think I told you last time, you know, we can't fight it appropriately with the aggressive tactics because we don't have the personnel to, say, put fire on the ground, which could have stopped it in a smaller area. Things like that. So as it gets bigger, you know, more accidents happen, more tragedies happen. With any big fire, the bigger it gets, the more people you get on it, the more injuries you're going to have. So I think it all kind of goes in that, you know.
What about the fitness standards? Is it still the PAC test? Is still the holy grail at the moment?
It is. And I think on all sides of fire, the problem with the fitness standards are, you know, once people promote to certain levels, they let themselves go and look at the younger generation to do the work. And that's where I think we're messing up, because continued leadership is necessary throughout the entirety of the time to keep everybody fit and in shape. You know, you're a problem if you're out there on the fire and you're not in shape.
What have you seen as far as that? What's the history? Again, the old heads, were they all in pretty good shape back then? I know they weren't probably thinking about nutrition and, you know, some of the high level strength and conditioning that we are now aware of, but were they traditionally able to do the job a lot more than obviously what you're witnessing today?
I believe so. But, and I would have that fall back a little bit too on just the American diet, you know? What's in our food now is making us all worse. I don't think that 20, 30 years ago, even people ate as bad or wasn't so much shit in the food. You know, so overall, it's just getting worse and worse and worse. You know, you have your people who hold themselves accountable, and I respect that. You have to choose to eat clean. You have to choose to stay on your fitness. And a lot of people don't. And then when you don't pay attention to what you're putting in your body, especially nowadays with all the stuff they put in the food, you're going to get bad.
Well, you're fighting a battle. I mean, we all know that there are food scientists that are paid to make the food more addictive. Same as the cigarettes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just tobacco in cigarettes. There's all these other things that are designed to keep you smoking more, and now the vapes. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I said this, I'm sure we talked about this before, but, you know, I grew up on a farm in England where we had an orchard and we had a vegetable garden and, you know, we ate our own meat. So I'm not going to stand on an ivory tower and say, well, why don't you eat like me? Well, I grew up in an environment that set me up for success. I was very, very lucky. But you grew up inner city, you know, in the bodega or the fish and chip shop or whatever it is mm-hmm. where you normally eat, and you watch TV and you're not really out there. And even if you wanted to be out there, maybe where you live is dangerous and the basketball courts are run by a gang. I mean, it's a very, very different environment. So
yeah, I really like your perspective and understanding of how people's environments truly do dictate, no matter how strong they are, on a lot of the paths that they go down. I agree with you 100%, you know, and it's hard. You really have to choose. Like me and my wife, we get our meats from the butcher shop now because it's got less shit pumped into it. You know, we try to, you have to be mindful of it. And yeah, the surroundings that you grew up in truly do dictate how you eat. You're right. People on ranches and farms, they eat a lot better because it's their environment. They grew up normalizing that. Yeah. Instead of normalizing Taco Bell and Jack in the Box.
Well, I think that's where, you know, the value is in that story. You know, we should be hearing from the farmers. Those are the experts in, you know, the holistic farmers, the organic farmers, you know, the ones doing the rotational, you know, grass finished beef and all these old school practices. That's who we should be listening to about food. And, you know, all of a sudden you turn a pyramid upside down and you're told, okay, now we fixed it. No, we haven't. Yeah. Like the quality of the food is a big part of it. Like you said, are you getting actual beef that was, you know, able to roam around and then be processed in a natural way? Or are you eating chicken breasts that's pumped with antibiotics and hormones and saline and everything else that this chicken looks like it could bench 400 pounds? Which of those two are you getting?
Yeah. So true, man. It really is. And you don't even realize it in this, you know, they're even with the, what is it? The Gatorades, even in other countries, I think in the UK, they allow different ingredients. And I think I read something on the cereal. God, what was it? Some brand, but they're allowed to put like 28 different type of chemicals in our cereal compared to like even Canada or something like that. Can't be, I'm not 100% sure. It was a long time ago, but I just remember reading something like that and like, wow, it's what the government allows.
Yep. I know when RFK was talking about removing the food dye, when I was a child, like really, really young, there was a big thing in England called E-numbers, and it was those colors and preservatives, and they removed them then. So we're talking early 1980s. So for 2025 to be the big revelation that you removed a preservative or a coloring from food, that's not to be celebrated. The question is why, like you said, why have we been putting it in the food for so long? You know, so
it's sad. You know, I have that problem. Like with my clients, I'm just always trying to get them to pay attention to the food being the biggest factor. You know, I have some that will work their ass off, but they don't change those little things. And so they'll lose a little bit of quick weight immediately, especially if they stop drinking or go on like a 10-day sugar cleanse, whatever it is. But it's buying all that regular stuff from, you know, the store, and those small little things keep you stuck.
Absolutely. What about psychology? Yeah. This is one of the things that I was educated on a few years ago now. There's a book called Chasing the Scream with Johann Hari. It's about addiction. And this one example, there was a study on diet, and they used IV nutrition with all these you know, people that volunteered. And this one woman was the rock star of the study, and she lost all this weight. And then one day she disappeared. And they're like, what the hell is going on? And they tracked her down, and someone who was very astute that was part of the study said, well, let's just, you know, interview us, find out what's going on. And as they progressed through this conversation, they said, well, look, when did you first start binge eating? And she said, when I was 10. And he said, well, did anything happen to you around that age? And she said, yeah, that was when my grandfather first started molesting me. And so what had happened with this woman is, as she lost weight and she got the attention of the opposite sex in this case, it was a complete alarm response and she didn't want it and she started eating again. Oh, wow. So we talk about food as far as caloric intake and exercise. What have you seen as far as the underlying why of some of your clients and maybe even the mental health element of some of these challenges?
Well, I haven't ran into something that deep or it hasn't been shared with me, if so. But mostly it's environment. It's the way people grow up. It's the normalization of barbecues. You know, you go to the barbecue, you eat all this crap, drink beer, and everybody does it every weekend. Sporting events, you show up, you snack on all this crap, you drink beer. It's the environment, the social dynamic of it being so normalized all over the place. That's the constant problem. I'm curious about what you, that's an interesting dynamic about the woman who didn't want that kind of attention. You know, that's a pretty deep psychological little aspect to that. But I could see that being a thing for women who wouldn't want attention. You know, that makes a lot of sense. You know, and then just so, you know, socially over the years, men are, it's okay for men to be out of shape and kind of let themselves go. And then this kind of leads me into saying, like, women are the one who do the work in my program, because women take care of themselves and take pride in their appearance and want to work on their mental health and stay consistent. In my experience, most of my successful clients have been women. And, you know, you have some men who are strong-willed and want change and continue through. And I've had success with men. I'm not saying that men can't be, but for the most part, women are the ones who take care of themselves and make the changes. But with the biggest hurdle is the lifestyle, what's normalized, the social drinks, the how you hang out with people, you go out to dinner, all those type of things are what's in the way.
Why do you think that women are more successful than men in this particular journey?
I think because, well, there's a couple different answers for that. It could be the overall, women are expected with their looks to be, well, I don't want to sound, you know, it is, you know, they take more pride in their appearance and their physical appearance. So they care about that and do it, where men, like I was saying, are more, it's accepted to have the dad bod, people call it, or the beer belly and stuff like that, where it's not the same for women. So in that context, you know, there is a difference.
What was interesting to me, and I've told this story many times, but I don't think we talked about it. When I first came to this country, after a while, I kept hearing the same kind of story. I call it the Uncle Rico story. Mm-hmm. Where I would have, you know, men that were in their, let's say, late 20s, early 30s, and over again, I woulda, shoulda, coulda been, you know, NFL, NBA, Major League, whatever it was, if it wasn't for my MCL, my shoulder, my insert career-ending injury here. But at this point, they're deconditioned. And coming from the UK, where we just didn't train at a high level for a sport. A lot of us played sports, but it was kind of like, if you were naturally gifted to be a football, you know, soccer player, you would find yourself, you know, in those particular grooming journeys, and then ultimately play for a Premier League or something. But the rest of us, we just played. So there wasn't a high level of physical pressure. There wasn't a high level of, you know, physical stress. And so when we graduated school, of this generation at least, people would keep playing the sport. They'd play pub leagues and local leagues and, you know, football and rugby and cricket and all the things that we played. And so at that time, you had people in the 30s, 40s, 50s that were still very active and still relatively fit and in, you know, decent shape. What I saw in America was we took our high school and college kids, forged an elite level of performance, but arguably at the detriment of their health and wellness. So once they broke, now they were physically burnt out, they were mentally burnt out, and you didn't see a continuation of a healthy, active lifestyle.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So a lot of these men that you work with, did a lot of them report being athletes when they were younger? Because, I mean, that's a huge issue.
I mean, 100%. You hit the nail on the head, man. That's they come and they either played high school sports or college sports, or did all these things. And then after that, just started working, trying to provide for the family, got caught up in it. And that being their whole get down, then beers at night to wind down. And it's the same story over and over and over and over again.
Yeah. I think it just does a disservice to, again, like I said, the longevity of that adult. You know, if you can keep them enjoying sport, and I think the multi-sport athlete is the healthiest one, even if you are forging performance, but so they don't get burnt out on a sport. They're not doing, you know, baseball and then travel ball and then performance clinics and all these things. And then all of a sudden they blow out their shoulder and now they're not playing. But if we can get these kids to still play at a high level, but really be cognizant of what comes next, I think that would be an important part for reducing the obesity that we see in this country, because people will continue to just play. They'll enjoy playing rather than be forced to win. And I hate this participation trophy conversation, because that's what sport is. It's participation. And I don't know if you are different. I've never seen a team of anyone who put zero effort in given a medal. Like, you run the London Marathon, you get a medal at the end. You run a Tough Mudder, you get a medal at the end. You compete in jiu-jitsu, and there's four people in your category, you're probably going to get a medal. So that's what happens when you put the work in and you do something. You should be proud of that medal. But if you're telling that if you're not worth a damn unless you won first place, to me, that's horrible messaging.
I agree with that. I've never really thought about it in the way that you just laid it out. And I like it. I like the way that you see that. And I agree with you.
All right. Well, I've been yapping a lot. Let's get back to you.
No, it's good. It's good.
So what has been the metamorphosis of any, if any, over the last couple of years with the way that you're coaching and training now?
Well, you just continue to learn so much about the human dynamics in it all too. You know, you learn so much from each different person. So I've been enjoying that along the way. I think that's my favorite part, is working with different people and learning. You know, like I just said, it's always the same story, right? But each person also has their individuality in it. And it's fun to be able to dive in with someone and help them find that grit that's still there, or their strength, you know, and it helps build mine too, each person I work with. So just, I've been continuing to grow with that. My wife's been really involved with me. She's gotten even more involved over the past couple of years. My kids. So it's been really developing well.
What about success stories? What are some notable journeys that you've witnessed the last couple of years since we last spoke?
I would say one of my favorite is one of my friends actually from here. He joined, and this falls back on a conversation that we were having about the environment, right? So he grew up in the same environment, drinking all the times, regular barbecues on the weekend. Just the entirety of the lifestyle. Well, he got tired of it. I think he was 32, because he's been with me now for just over a year. And in the first 30 days, he stopped drinking. He lost 30 pounds in the first 30 days, changed his entire way of eating. Everything that he had normalized, just got tired of it and stopped. And still every single day, he's tagging me in workouts. He just committed and has stayed at it, and his drive is changing the story that his kids are growing up in by who he is. And that's what it's about. That's what my whole program's about, and he's one of the most powerful examples of it.
What was it that made him turn the corner at that particular moment that obviously hadn't worked prior to that?
You know, that's kind of a hard one. I would just say he got tired of it, you know, and he saw all the patterns, because you have to step back and look at all the patterns around us. And he did that. And then he saw what his kids were seeing as the normalized patterns, and he wanted to change that. So he made a hard decision and stuck to it. And that's what it takes. So it was just being tired of the same patterns and watching the same shit go on, and didn't want to see the same thing with kids. The same thing that happened with me. That was the decision I made. I wanted to change the story. I wanted to change the patterns. So that's what it took for me. And I think that's what it takes for anybody.
We were talking about my most recent book, and one of the biggest themes in that is generational trauma. And that can be a negative, you know, until you actually see it and you see these dominoes falling from generation to generation. But if you then really, really take a step back and look at everything that's happened prior, you can then stop it from falling on your child. You do the work, you fix yourself, you stop it from, you know, being passed on. And when you're talking about, you know, this particular gentleman's story, I'm thinking immediately of the CrossFit. It's not the CrossFit anymore, but I was in a CrossFit gym and we've transitioned to a different kind of programming now. But the strength and conditioning gym that I've been a part of for, I think it's 11 years now, and all the parents that I've seen from, you know, not having a child to pregnancy to having a child now, these kids are 8, 9, 10, 12 years old. And it's the same thing, generational growth, I guess you could call it. When these children see their parents taking their health seriously, eating well, trying to, you know, reduce or abstain from alcohol, you know, going to the gym 3-4 times a week or doing jiu-jitsu or doing a mud run, that then is that child's norm. That's their baseline. Yes. And you watch these kids that grow up in gyms become healthy, happy, fit children themselves. So I think it's a beautiful analogy of the opposite of generational trauma is watch these children that grow up in these active areas and they literally end up following the exact same path.
100%, man. That is exactly how I feel about it. I love that aspect of the whole lifestyle. And you have to lead by example, especially if that's been the normal for so long and so many generations of your family. You have to continue and continue and continue, and eventually it'll change and they'll follow along.
You mentioned alcohol, and I know I remember seeing it. I actually went back on Instagram and it popped up again. You did a video on, you know, each glass you were filling up as far as, you know, the impact. So talk to me about that. You know, we collectively, a lot of us were raised, I mean, in the UK, alcohol is a part of our culture. I mean, every tiny village has a post office, a church, and a pub. Talk to me about, again, how you viewed alcohol early life, and then what was that change for you?
Well, it's still normalized, man. God, I used to drink to get drunk. That was the intent. You know, we weren't, so this falls back on some people who socially drink, right? In my environment that I grew up in, we would grab a couple 30 packs, a couple bottles, and the intent was to finish it, not have a couple drinks and then save some for tomorrow. All that needs to be gone. You know, so I grew up with that being normalized. And even when I started in fire, I obviously couldn't really party on the weekdays because you can't go hike and fight fire hungover. But on my weekends, I would do the same thing. I would get my 30 pack, my bottle of tequila, and I'd finish it. And it was just normalized in my life. I thought that's what was normal. And that became not okay, especially as my kids started becoming teenagers. And I saw so much around me falling apart, people dying, people making stupid decisions, losing their families. There's so many horrible stories that come from drinking, and not much that of the opposite. You know, I've never woke up and not had a hangover and thought, man, I wish I drank last night. But the opposite is true with the other side of that, right? So for me, I just decided that I needed to change that pattern. You know, my dad had a big drinking and drug problem. I've just seen it everywhere in my life, and I didn't want that for my kids anymore. They were becoming teenagers, and I just decided I was done. I wanted to change the cycle of what life was around us and be something different and create a new direction for my family.
That can be a challenge for a lot of people, though, myself included. I mean, I've never been a binge drinker, but I've said this many times, I've been a frequent drinker. When I get into a groove, I'll have, you know, a couple of glasses of wine or whatever in an evening, and knowing damn well I have a podcast about health and knowing that it's going to disrupt my sleep. What tools did you use to kind of break the binds that alcohol had up to that point?
I had to take a hard look at my reality and what it's been, how I truly feel about it, and really create an understanding in my mind about what the consequence of not changing that was. So, you know, I know some people can drink here and there, and that's cool. You know, I still go hang out at a football game. People are drinking. It's not a thing. I just choose not to because it's in the way of what I want, you know. But that video that I made on Instagram is a prime example of where it leads and from my perspective of what it leads to. You know, the first drink, you're good. And then, you know, the effect it has on other people as you progress. And then, well, there's always more to where I don't give a shit. You know, it's a pattern that I've seen. That's my perspective of it. And so for me, I had to decide, really look back and think that's not okay, because I care about other people too. I love my wife. I love my kids. That's what matters to me. So that's not going to be a part of my life. So I had to really sit back, analyze what my life is, what I see the effect of that is, not only to me, but all the examples I have around me, and then make a decision. And I know it's not easy, especially like we talk about, it's normalized around you. And then it becomes, that's how you understand to socialize. You know, everybody thinks that, you know, you go to dinner, have a couple of drinks, you guys bullshit, and that's what's normalized. But then what? Then you get in the car and drive. You know, there's a lot of things that are just not okay with it, in my opinion. And I had to just really set back, like I said, and pay attention to what that is and what that means to me.
How many months after stopping did you really, really feel like you were back to 100%?
Well, even the way I stopped drinking, I would say it was a long road, because in my 30s, I would still have drinks, and even maybe too many drinks, probably a handful of times throughout that whole decade. You know, I never really put a stop to it in my head. I just thought, I'm going to stop that lifestyle, but here and there, I'll still have drinks. So I would say at the end of my 30s, when I decided to really say, you know what, I'm done with it, the feeling better and noticing a difference was kind of immediate at that point. Because it was more mental, of knowing that I'm done with that and I'm going to be better and do better. So that made me feel a different way. Does that make sense?
No, it does. It does. I think one of the barriers I've found is, because I've stopped for months at a time and waiting for the, you know, you see it on social media. This is what 1 week looks without alcohol, 1 month. And I'm there like, when am I going to feel clearer headed and sleep deeper? But I think my reality, and I'm actually going to go to a retreat next month, is to address maybe some elements that I just can't see. You know, there's nothing that bothers me per se, but there's got to be something back there hidden that is stopping me from really gleaning all the benefits of, you know, sobriety and all the other things that I do. Because I think there's nothing more discouraging than taking alcohol out and not really feeling any different, which is my personal journey. You know, if I felt better, I'd be so enthused and so motivated, but I still don't sleep well. I mean, I sleep okay, but I don't, the quality of sleep. And that's the piece that I'm missing. I get everything that everyone's telling me. And like I said, I can hit stop for a long time, but then when I hit start, it becomes frequent again. But it would be so much more encouraging if I felt so much better without the alcohol. And I don't know if anyone else listening has had the same experience, but when there's really no difference between the two, it takes away some of the power of leaning away from it when you don't really notice a difference between the two, which is bizarre. Now, acutely, like the day after, a couple of days after drinking, absolutely, I notice more of a difference by not drinking. But as you progress through it, I'm hoping that my brain is going to get clearer and clearer, and, you know, inflammation is going to get less and less, like it should happen. I guess there's other things in my physiology that are stopping me from getting that full benefit of not drinking at all.
Yeah, because it sounds like you don't have a drinking problem to where the effects of somebody who drinks a lot more than it sounds like you do would notice those effects immediately. You know, like my client that I was talking about, him stopping the drinking in 30 days, his life changed dramatically. The inflammation, his mental health, all those things were pretty much immediate in that 30 days, because he was living a lifestyle so heavy in it before that he really did feel those effects. And now he's created a lifestyle, proper nutrition, working out, where he has a goal too, where now that drinking would be in his way. So mentally he feels better knowing that that's not an obstacle. It's all those different things that are in it. So it depends on really how much of a factor it plays in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the other thing is when the more functional you are, and again, when I talk about drinking, like I said, it's not a high level drinking per session, but when you add units up together, if you drink every evening and have a couple of glasses of wine, that still adds up. That is an issue. But if you compensate well, like you said, if you still, you know, functioning really well as a police officer or a firefighter the next day, you know, then it kind of is like, well, it's okay then, you know, there's that little voice in your head. And so by removing it and not really feeling effects because everything else you do is probably pretty good, it's an interesting psychology because it's not as motivating. But if you saw a big change, of course, I think a lot more people would be like, okay, well, then I'm not drinking again because this is so much better. But when there isn't that acute difference, it's almost harder to completely let it go when you're not seeing that contrast.
Yeah, and that's when you have to depending on the patterns of your families or the people who are close to you around you, like how does drinking affect them, you know?
Yeah.
And how could your example of normalizing drinking affect maybe your kid who would then normalize it and then maybe not be able to handle it as well as you and then have some adverse, you know, it's a hard one, man, because you also have to get out of yourself and think about how it affects other people. You have all these people with DUIs every day, drinking, you know, it's hurting other people. I mean, there's so many different things. So yeah. I look at it like that too. Like what would be the example that I'm setting for my kids if I'm normalizing that? I've become to think that alcohol is like a poison, man. It's horrible in society. And people, it's so normalized that people get in their cars and, you know, after having good amount of beer or drinks at dinner and then just drive home like it's normal. And then what if you hurt somebody else? So maybe you're okay with it, but how are you affecting the people that are watching you, that you're leading, you know, who might not be able to handle it so well because it's normalized. So it's all those things.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree completely. I mean, my thing is I've realized, okay, well, if it's not the alcohol per se, then what else can I look into? Which is why I'm trying some alternative things that I will talk about on the podcast in the future. But, you know, to me, it's like I was talking about the thing beneath the thing. What is the reason for depression, anxiety, you know, the reason that you reach for a drink? Sometimes you just don't know what it is. I'm not haunted by calls. I don't have anything in my childhood that, you know, that I'm aware of, at least it's buried down. So I've got to kind of pull back the curtain and see, right, what is that thing?
So then what's your problem with drinking? Why do you think it's a problem then? And because it doesn't sound like it is in your life.
Because you hit the nail on the head. It's a poison. And I'm fully aware that it's a poison. So even if I'm operating at 90% and we can never get to 100%, I want to get to 95. I want to optimize. I want to be able to, like you said, be anywhere and have a beautiful conversation with a glass of water instead of a glass of wine. So I'm just aware of the hypocrisy.
Yeah. And that's the thing. A great way to answer that is it's in the way of being the best version of yourself, because it's something that alters your state of mind and alters your health. So it's something in the way. That's for me. Like I don't want to have a drink because it's in the way of what my goals are. It's just another thing. So,
yeah.
And it sounds like that's what it is for you, is you want to hold yourself to a higher standard, both mentally and physically. And that's something when it shows up in your life that's in your way and doesn't make sense.
I think it mirrors what I've talked about a lot recently when it comes to the mental health conversation. You have a certain group of us who are in crisis, and those men and women, you need to pull away from the darkness and get it to where they can think clearly again and then kind of walk them forward. But I think a lot of people aren't walking around so much, you know, with suicide ideation or crippling addiction, but they're you know, they're in need of help. And we frame this whole mental health conversation as, you know, these broken people. And, you know, it's a very sad, dark conversation. But if you look at the tools for mental health, they also optimize performance. Like if you want a wildland firefighter or a law enforcement officer to be able to critically think when the winds shift and the clouds are changing, or God forbid, someone's reaching into their pocket in the back of a restaurant, you want to be as close to 100% as you can. And where I see the mental health conversation is, all right, what if we just want to be a better firefighter, a better dad, a better, you know, interviewer? These same tools can help you forge performance. So I think that's with this alcohol conversation is the same thing. I'm not drowning in alcoholism, but I'm fully aware that this crutch is still, you know, holding me back from as close to optimization as I can. And this, it's really just a red flag. There's something that's still holding me back. And how can I address that? So I think it's kind of exciting because if we frame mental health the same way and you use these tools to optimize performance, so at 3 a.m, we've been banged out and now all of a sudden we're at a pediatric cardiac arrest, that you can operate at that highest level rather than just using the mental health conversation when someone's talking about suicide.
Yeah, that's well put, man. It really is. Yeah, the drinking, you know, there's a big difference between alcoholism, social drinking, and all those other factors. And you just got to know what yours is. And for me, like I said, it's in the way, and I want to be able to operate at 100%, well, close to 100%, you know, as I can all the time. You know, there's something I tell people, because it's not always about just the alcoholism, it's the lifestyle, right? So when you choose to get hammered drunk, right, and say you have a family and you're passed out at 3 a.m. on the couch because you drank too much, what if somebody decides to come into your home?
Yep.
And you're blacked out drunk. What are you going to do to protect your family? You know, so fall back on priorities, lifestyle changes, all those different things, you know?
100%. Well, speaking of optimized, what has been the evolution of WildFit Life 805 in the last couple of years? And talk to me about the supplementation side that you've expanded.
Yeah, man. I've really been trying to bring out new supplements. I think a lot of the stuff that you can get has too much crap in it. So I tried to get with a company that's third-party tested, good stuff, just nice and clean, because I don't think everybody should be taking all kinds of crap all the time. So I'll come out with the protein, a pre-workout, creatine, and multivitamins for men and women. And I just think they have the perfect what you need in them, and you don't need to be taking all kinds of other shit. Even the pre-workout, I tell people you shouldn't be taking that every day. It would make me more money if you took it every day, but I don't think you should be using pre-workout every day. So all those things, it's been coming a long way, going good. The coaching has been going good. Again, that's one of my favorite parts of my life, is working with people and being able to create that personal relationship and growth together. Every person I work with helps me too. So I love that. And, you know, it's gotten me in touch with different type of people. Like, I've been getting involved in movies, little TV shows. You just never know where it's going to lead. And I don't turn down opportunities, and I just stay trying to grow and push. So it's been going really well. We're starting a fund right now. We're going to do this thing where, you know, we lost our son, about one of our sons, about 2 months ago in an accident.
I didn't know that. I don't think.
That's why we rescheduled. But
oh, I'm so sorry, brother.
Yeah, no, thank you. But we're doing this thing with our supplements where we're starting a fund in his name, where we're gonna send one kid to an NBA basketball camp each year in his name. So, you know, we're gonna do that as a part of a way to carry him on and honor that. And so, a lot of stuff like that going on. Good.
Let's talk about that. How can people listening contribute? How can they help?
I would say just, you know, the sale of the supplements is going to go towards sending that kid to a camp each year. Other than that, just not much in regards to that, really, beyond that.
What about the grief journey that you and your wife have been on then? Talk to me about, you know, what has worked, if anything, at the moment? Because I mean, you talk about any challenges as far as mental health and emotional. I mean, losing a child is about as bad as it can get.
Yeah. And he was actually hit by a drunk driver, so that kind of falls back on the topic we were just having. But the grief has been a interesting path. But what helps is the tools that are in place. You know, we've stayed on routine, continued trying to eat good, are working out, and having each other. You know, we're doing like family counseling, which is real good. And just staying as one and using the tools that we have in place already, like with the fitness and all that. You know, there's really no, it's unforgiving. And we're being here for each other and just, you know, continuing down that path. Having those things in place, like the working out and the eating right, is also powerful in it all.
I'm creating something for television, and I'll talk to you after we round off this conversation. But I'd love to get you on there, because it will address one of the issues that's behind exactly what you've told us. So I'll just leave that cryptic at the moment, and we'll talk after. For people listening then, where are the best places to find the workouts, the supplements, and if you want to expand on what kind of coaching is available there?
So we're Wild Fit Life 805, and that's on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Justin Mahaffey on Facebook. We share all the workouts that we do. I do put a lot of follow-alongs on YouTube, free for people. I have different programs that I offer. I have a low-price program that I like to keep in place for people who are actually struggling, single moms, just people going down a path where money's tight. And then I have programs that are really serious, you know, up to, you know, you pay a good amount and you get 6 months and you get supplements included. And it's all one-on-one coaching. I build you meal plans, workout plans. We do live Zoom workouts multiple times a week. You can join from anywhere in the world. Got this, like I said, the supplements, apparel. And, you know, the things with the program is if you commit for 3 to 6 months to a program and then go back to your normal lifestyle, it's going to be a waste. The way I do my program is you'll pay the fees and then I have like an incentive. Once you reach your goal, I drop it down to $35 a month and you stay a part of Wild Fit Life for life. And I'll continue to build your programs, so you're a part of what the community is. So that's one of my favorite things about my program.
Beautiful. Well, I want to throw a few closing questions at you again before I let you go. The first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our conversation today or completely unrelated.
A book. Let's go with your book. You know, the book I always try to recommend to people, and I told my kids to read it, and is Tony Robbins' book. It's called Awaken the Giant Within. And that was my favorite book since I was a kid. And I've recommended it multiple times on podcasts too. I think that's a good starting point to really try to understand yourself. It's got good tools in it.
Fantastic. What about TV, film, documentary?
I would say Tombstone and Gladiator. Those are my two favorite movies. As far as documentaries, I don't really know. I don't watch very many documentaries.
And talk to me about the Mayans. So you mentioned about being exposed to the world of entertainment now. What are some of the roles that you've been in?
So there's a movie that I'm doing where I'm playing the lead detective. I'm not sure how that's going to play out or when that's supposed to come out. I'm supposed to film some more scenes in April. And then the Mayans thing, I have a guy, they make short films and stuff. And he got with all the cast of the Mayans and he's doing a final episode. And he asked me to come down and be in it. So I went and I just had one scene. It was pretty cool. I took my truck down there. One of my sons went with me and he did the microphone and stuff. So it was a cool experience. I think that's coming out really soon.
Brilliant. I'll have to look for that then. All right. Well, next question. Is there a person that you recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military and associated professions of the world?
You know, I do have a friend in mind. Jason Mitchell would be a good person to talk to about the fire service and the whole development of it. He's been involved in the development of our Type 2 crew, the engine world, and he's dealt with a lot of stuff in the fire world, and be a good guest to have.
Brilliant. I appreciate that. All right. Well, the last question for you, make sure everyone knows where to find you. We'll just reiterate. What do you do to decompress these days?
Sauna and laying in bed watching TV with my wife. That's our decompression every single night.
We just got into watching Yellowstone. I don't know if you've seen that show, but
yeah, watching it's that. A good one. Have you seen Landman?
Not yet. No, I heard that was a similar kind of concept.
Yeah, it's good too. We're watching that one, and we're doing this other one, Lioness. Those are our two shows we're watching at night.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah. That being said, of all television or film, who's done the best job of showing the Wildland Fire Service, do you think?
That's a hard one. I don't really think it's been I guess kind of that CAL FIRE one's not too far off the, I mean, that is kind of, can't remember the name of that show, but Only the Brave, man. That was a good depiction of the way that we trained together, the camaraderie. So I would say that. Probably Only the Brave. You know, it's a little Hollywood, but expected to be. But I think they did a pretty good job of showing what it's about.
Yeah, they certainly captured the emotion of the whole thing. No question about that. Yeah. All right. So just reiterate one more time. If people want to reach out to you or find the programming, where can they find it?
WildFitLife805.com or on any social media.
Brilliant. Well, yeah. Justin, I want to thank you again. It's been such an amazing conversation. I'm so, so sorry for the tragedy that your family's endured recently, but I hope that people listening will, you know, go visit the website, look at the coaching, look at the supplements, and be able to show you that there is this fire family that is trying to help from the outside as well.
Yeah, thank you so much, man. I appreciate it. It was an honor being back on your show and talking with you. Hope we do it again one day.